This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Biofuels like corn ethanol have been hailed as a climate-friendly source of energy. But a new study says that burning those alternative fuels is actually twice as bad as burning gasoline from the standpoint of global warming. As NPR's Richard Harris reports, if the findings hold, they could force major changes in the rapidly growing biofuels industry.
At first blush, biofuels like corn ethanol and soybean diesel seem like they'd be great from the standpoint of global warming. The crops soak up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere as they grow, and that balances out the carbon dioxide they produce when they're burned. But until now, nobody has fully analyzed all the ripple effects of this industry. And Tim Searchinger, a visiting scholar at Princeton University, says those effects turn out to be huge.
The simplest explanation is that when we divert our corn or soybeans to fuel, if people around the world are going to continue to eat the same amount that they're already eating, you have to replace that food somewhere else.
Searchinger and his colleagues looked globally to figure out where the new cropland is coming from as American farmers produce fuel crops where they used to grow food. The answer is that biofuel production here is driving agriculture to expand in other parts of the world.
That's done in significant part by burning down forest, plowing up grassland. That releases a great deal of carbon dioxide.
In fact, their study, published online today by Science Magazine, shows those actions end up releasing huge amounts of carbon dioxide. The study finds that over a 30-year span, biofuels end up contributing twice as much carbon dioxide to the air as the amount of gasoline would when you add in these global effects.
Right now, there's little doubt that ethanol is making global warming worse.
Searchinger's team says these fuels are turning out to be anything but environmentally friendly. Alex Farrell at the University of California, Berkeley, agrees.
I think this paper will have major implications for the use of biofuels around the world.
Here in the United States, the federal government is offering large subsidies to encourage corn-based ethanol. That's a boon to Midwestern farmers and provides a domestic supply of fuel. The Bush administration is calling for a vast expansion of this industry as part of a plan to reduce gasoline consumption by 20%.
If you care about greenhouse gases, then this expansion of the corn biofuel industry is going in the wrong direction.
Farrell says the new study will clearly need to be verified with similar analyses, but he says the overall conclusion looks solid. And it's not just an academic matter. Federal law says future biofuel sources will eventually need to be certified as benefiting the climate. If the new study holds up to scrutiny, America's main industry, corn-based ethanol, would flunk that test.
Well, what is their solution?
Matt Hartwig is a spokesman for the Renewable Fuels Association, a trade group. He says the world needs more energy, and ethanol is filling a need.
I mean, sure, today ethanol production or renewable fuel technology itself is not perfect, but it is evolving and becoming better.
But the new study concludes that even vast efficiency improvements in ethanol production won't change the equation. As long as the starting material is grown on farmland, Searchinger says biofuels will be bad for the planet. But Alex Farrell at Berkeley does see a way out of this. He says the focus of the biofuels industry needs a rapid change of direction, away from using cropland, which is where most U.S. biofuels come from today, and toward other sources of starting material.
We could replace all of the ethanol that we consume in California just using waste that goes to the landfill today and turning that into ethanol.
Environmentally friendly biofuels could also be made from agricultural waste or grasses grown on land that's not suitable for crops. The biofuels industry is heading in that direction, but the technology to make use of fuels other than corn and soy is still in its infancy. Richard Harris, NPR News.
The oil industry made a record bid yesterday for oil and gas leases off Alaska, $2.6 billion. The controversial lease sale offered 29 million acres in the waters of the Chukchi Sea. Those waters are home to the polar bear. The polar bear could be the first species to be listed as threatened, with its possible extinction due to climate change. Elizabeth Arnold reports from Anchorage.
24,103,000.
If you've never been to an oil lease sale, it's sort of like a Sotheby's auction without the glitz and glamour. It was minus 10 outside, and inside, geologists in old sweaters, Native Alaskans in fur-lined parkas, and a few oil industry execs in suits and snow boots stared at a huge map of the Chukchi Sea. It was divided up into tiny blocks as bids were opened and read over a period of 3 hours.
Block 7012, one bid. Shell Gulf of Mexico Incorporated, $10,006,427.
Instead of paintings and furniture, chunks of the Arctic Ocean were for sale. And at the end of the bidding, a record total was offered for the rights to drill in 2.7 million acres of seabed over the next 10 years.
The highest bid was $105,304,581 by Shell Gulf of Mexico.
That's about $18,000 an acre, if you do the math. And Minerals Management Service Director Randall Luthy positively beamed. He estimates a reserve of some 15 billion barrels of recoverable oil in the Chukchi, but he was a bit on the defensive, as his agency has been sued for insufficient consideration of environmental impacts there. Nevertheless, the sale proceeded as planned, and Luthy pledged vigilance.
It gives us a great opportunity to show that we can develop these resources the way they should be developed, which includes an environmentally sound and protected manner.
The residents of 8 remote villages along the coastline, 50 miles from the lease sites, aren't so sure. While many have supported oil drilling in the past on land, they fear oil spills at sea will hurt their subsistence lifestyle, which includes fishing and harvesting whales and seals. George Edwardson is the president of the Inupiat Arctic Slope communities, who are actively opposing the sale. He says simply, the sea is our life.
For me, the reason I push so hard in the direction I'm going, I have 7 children, 5 girls and 2 boys. The last 2 years, those girls have been doing my hunting for me out in the ocean. I have no choice.
Despite the remoteness and logistical difficulties of drilling in the Chukchi, recent record demand for oil and high prices have led to a renewed interest in the area by the industry. Industry watchdog Rick Steiner shakes his head over the amounts of the bids. He's a professor with the University of Alaska Marine Advisory Program. He points out that the Minerals Management Service itself has estimated a 50% probability of an oil spill in the lease area and says more than a dozen species there are already listed as threatened, not to mention new consideration of the polar bear.
What we've done to the Arctic ecosystem in the next 10, 20, 30 years looks pretty bad, and to be imposing this additional risk and impact on it, knowing that it's going to cause a major oil spill and not caring and going ahead with it anyway, that, you know, sort of like the last phase of an addiction where the addict will stop at nothing.
Shell Gulf of Mexico, consistently the most vigorous bidder, called the sale a great day for Alaska and a great day for Shell. Annelle Bay, the vice president for exploration, says a polar bear listing wouldn't make much difference to the company's plans for the leased area. And with a bright, reassuring smile, she repeated Shell's environmental mantra.
Everywhere we operate, we do so safely and responsibly. We not only comply with the regulations, but we go beyond that.
The lease sale is just part of a larger program aimed at opening millions of acres to offshore oil exploration. Shell and the Minerals Management Service hope it's the first of many lease sales before the administration changes hands. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Anchorage.
Good morning, I'm Renee Montaigne. With the holy season of Lent upon us, the bishops of London and Liverpool have come up with a new kind of 40-day fast. Instead of giving up your favorite chocolate or Chardonnay, how about cutting down on carbon? Along with the aid agency Tear Fund, the British bishops have launched a carbon fast. This Lent, one could give up plastic bags or incandescent bulbs or any other carbon indulgence you can think of. We're going to hear now about a National Guardsman who survived an attack in Iraq, but now has died along with his family in the tornadoes that have left the South reeling. The tornadoes are the worst there in more than 25 years. At least 55 people have perished and hundreds more are injured. FEMA teams were dispatched to the region yesterday, and President Bush has promised federal aid. Most of the fatalities were in Tennessee, but deaths were also reported in Arkansas, Kentucky, and Alabama, where the storms hit before dawn and caught some families off guard. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
Lawrence County, Alabama, is mostly flat territory in the northwest part of the state. An occasional rolling hill gives you a long view out over green pastures and pine tree stands, so you couldn't miss the mark left when a monster twister cut through the Aldridge Grove community. John James is deputy director of the Alabama Emergency Management Agency.
We have a path about 16.7 miles long, about a quarter of a mile wide, to where the storm hit and done its entire damage.
It struck in the dark of night, about 3 a.m., when most residents were sleeping.
We weren't prepared at all.
Deborah Montgomery woke up to winds crashing in on her mobile home.
I felt pressure in my ears. I guess the windows were coming in. We got in the hall. That's the only place without windows, and just started praying.
She says her prayers were answered. The trailer's only slightly damaged, but a work shed out back is reduced to scrap. Strips of metal are wrapped around a tree, flapping in the stiff breeze the day after the storm. But across the street, it's a more dire scene. Members of the Alabama State Defense Force are picking through the remnants of a brick home that was flattened and spread 100 yards across the front yard. Part of its wooden roof is perched high in a tree across the street. You might think kids were building a treehouse if not for the devastation all around.
Hey, found a medal.
National Defense Medal.
No, good conduct.
First Lieutenant Will Wright is coordinating the cleanup.
This was a National Guardsman's home, and he served in Iraq. We're trying to find his box of ribbons, trying to help out the family, find as much of his stuff as we possibly can. He was in the Alabama Department of the Military just like we are, and we're going to do what we can for him.
The former Guardsman, Ray Coleman, his wife Rebecca, and their 19-year-old son Garrett were all killed. Rebecca's father, James Devaney, says Ray Coleman was a Humvee driver who had survived an attack in Iraq and came home suffering symptoms of post-traumatic stress. Ray and son Garrett had been working as plumbers. Rebecca Coleman was a cashier at the local Foodland grocery store.
It's a shock, man, a very big shock. But, you know, we don't know what we got. I don't have to appreciate this family, but they're not weeding no more. That's the way I look at it.
Devaney is looking for his daughter's gold necklace. The guardsmen haven't seen it, but they do uncover Garrett's small New Testament, his name inscribed in the shaky penmanship of a young child. The soldiers are visibly moved. They've been here in Aldrich Grove since before dawn. Lieutenant Wright says, in times like these, all you can do is pitch in. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. The tornadoes came fast and furious on Tuesday. On Wednesday, they hit before dawn when people were sleeping. In five southern states, at least 55 people were killed and hundreds injured. The rural areas outside Nashville, Tennessee, were the hardest hit, as NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
Northeast of Nashville, near the Kentucky border, the homes and trailers that sat near the golf course in tiny Lafayette, Tennessee, are now in pieces. Trees were sheared off, and some were literally ripped out of the ground, roots and all. Cars were flipped over. At least 31 people died in Tennessee, many here in Macon County.
As far as I know, past our houses, the golf course and that, everything's destroyed and gone. The whole neighborhood's gone.
At the Red Cross shelter set up inside the National Guard Armory in Lafayette, Elizabeth Wojciech is wrapped in a red blanket. You can see the distress in her tired eyes as she talks with some of her neighbors about losing their homes and trying to check on families they've not heard from yet.
We're exhausted. None of us have gotten any sleep at all. We're in shock.
In one of the back rooms, a doctor and some assistants care for those who've come in with minor injuries.
Just pull a little piece of wood out of his eyebrow there.
It's right here.
Yeah, we can irrigate it with some peroxide.
Dr. James Cole works on James Kruger, who was inside his home when the tornado hit. Kruger says he hit the floor and everything began swirling around him. As a result, he has a couple of cracked ribs, one black eye, scratches all over his face and back, and a cut on his forehead. The doctor is cleaning the area where he just removed a small piece of wood.
Okay, here we go.
Just don't move.
It's just a trip. I don't even... it's like... It was sliding and everything was just on you. That's all I remember. And then everything like was sucked forward for about 3 feet and then risen up. And what I just went through, I don't understand how I'm still here. And I know God didn't want me to leave.
It's hard for people here to believe that three tornadoes swept through Macon County. There were reports of dozens of tornadoes that touched down across the South. At least 13 people were killed in Arkansas, 7 in Kentucky, and 4 more in Alabama. Officials in Tennessee spent much of the day searching for victims, going door to door across downed power lines, rummaging through piles of debris. Kruger says his closest neighbor, an elderly woman, didn't make it.
My neighbor's house was gone, and I knew she was, Jesus took her. I knew that. Prayed for her, but they found her body in the trailer.
People here said they knew severe storms were possible, but they came on so fast and covered such an extensive area. Some did get to shelters. Others hid in their bathrooms and hallways. Now they have no homes to go back to. Elizabeth Wojciech says her husband took a few photos of their neighborhood and brought them back to her. She couldn't even look at them.
Me and my son, we're going to North Carolina Friday with my sister-in-law because we can't stand it. We got to get out of here for a little while. It's just that bad.
There's a sense of relief that the storms have passed, but the pain lingers as people realize they will have to face the destruction and figure out how to start over. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Hendersonville, Tennessee.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. If we say Clorox, chances are you think bleach or some other cleaning product with a stern safety warning. But Clorox is also making a big push into the market for eco-friendly cleaning supplies. It's a tiny but fast-growing business. NPR's Elaine Corey reports from San Francisco on the company's first new brand in decades, a line of green products.
In a Clorox test kitchen, scientist Sumi Kate leans over a white tile countertop that has a nasty grease stain. She's attacking it with one of the company's new GreenWorks cleaners.
So I'm going to spray the product. And one of the things you'll notice is that the grease literally starts to melt away. And so when you wipe the product, it's completely clean.
So, how does it work? Well, Clorox isn't telling. It's a closely guarded secret. They will say that scientists spent years perfecting a formula created from scratch, derived from plant-based ingredients such as coconuts and lemons. There are 5 cleaners in the new line, apple green liquids in bottles adorned with a bright yellow flower. We tested 4 of them, and they all seem to work as well as the leading competitor. Brand manager Matt Kohler says Clorox picked the name GreenWorks precisely to fight the perception among consumers that natural products don't work.
If you look at the green cleaning category right now, it's less than 1% of sales. So lots of consumers want green cleaning options, but they're not really adopting them because they're not satisfied with the options that are available to them. So we really felt like there was this market of underserved consumers.
A few small firms, such as Seventh Generation and Method, have been selling natural biodegradable household cleaners for years. But their products are expensive, and their loyal customers aren't typical consumers. They eat organic and shop at farmers markets or health food stores. Joel McCower, the editor of GreenBiz.com, says mainstream consumers are willing to try green products, but they're asking themselves a whole list of questions.
Yes, I want to buy a green product if it comes from a brand I know, if I buy it where I already shop, the quality is at least as good, price is the same, or maybe I'll pay a little bit more, and that it has some other benefit besides it being green, that it's healthier, or that it's just plain cool.
McCower says that's a high hurdle for new products, but he thinks GreenWorks may just have what it takes. This Safeway store east of San Francisco is promoting the new GreenWorks line with a $1 off coupon. Assistant manager Antoinette Kaluuya has bought a few of the cleaners, and she's impressed. She likes that they're effective while being less toxic.
Because I wanted something safer for the kids and for my house.
And what do you think?
I thought they worked well. They smell really good as well, so it didn't have that harsh smell, but it still worked really well. It was really refreshing, so I enjoyed the smell.
Kaluuya says the products just came out, so it's hard to say how they're doing. Joel McCower says the market conditions are right for more eco-friendly products to cross over into the mainstream.
2008 is going to be the year in which the big consumer companies start really bringing green products to market.
And Steve Ashkin, the executive director of the Green Cleaning Network, says the big consumer retailers, Walmart, Target, and major supermarket chains, are excited about these new brands. He says their commitment will propel even more product development.
This is going to heat up very quickly in the marketplace because none of the competition is going to want to be left out.
According to Ashkin, don't be surprised if Clorox rivals such as Procter & Gamble and SC Johnson also rush new green product lines to the shelves. Elaine Corey, NPR News, San Francisco.